Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, why is California's pathway from high school to college increasingly becoming a winding road? And what to do about it? We'll talk with the author of a new study who says even kids who start out on the right track are struggling with the current system in English and math. Speaking of education, we'll get a preview of something big that's happening in Tehachapi next week, the opening of a new home for the town's public library. And we'll get an update on the sexual harassment allegations that have now resulted in the resignation of a sitting California Assembly member and a conversation with GOP gubernatorial candidate John Cox. We begin, though, with the allegations of sexual harassment, racist comments, and a hostile work environment that begin much closer to home. Yesterday, the Madera County Board of Supervisors took the unusual step of publicly censuring the county's district attorney, David Lynn. The resolution, unanimously passed by the board, also called for Lynn's resignation. For his part, Lynn denies the claims and says they're politically motivated. Our reporter Carrie Klein was there and joins us now to tell us more. Carrie, welcome.
Hi, Joe.
This was a rather unusual setting, an unusual event. What was the scene like yesterday morning?
Yeah, this was unusual. The meeting took place first thing after a long holiday weekend, which is pretty rare. But still, the room was pretty full. I'd estimate maybe 50 or 60 people there, and it was certainly tense. The audience, the county supervisors, county council, everyone was there to discuss the workplace conduct of District Attorney David Lynn.
So this broke right before the Thanksgiving holiday that they were going to call this special meeting and ask for Lynn's resignation. What exactly are the allegations, and who is making them?
So the allegations are that he has made racist and sexist remarks, engaged in racist and sexist behavior, and also abusive and threatening behavior in the workplace. And he's made these comments about coworkers, to coworkers, and at least one case about a crime victim, allegedly. They were brought to light earlier this summer when a county employee filed a formal complaint against Lynn. And then this employee actually went on a leave of absence, fearing for his safety on the job.
So what do we know about the truthfulness of these allegations? And right now, that's what we're dealing with here. There has been no criminal investigation, but has there been any sort of independent look into these claims?
Yeah, in fact, there has been. And that's one of the reasons that this meeting was called yesterday. So it turns out that after that employee filed that complaint in July, the county decided to hire an outside law firm to investigate those claims. And so they spent the next couple of months collecting evidence, conducting interviews with witnesses. So yesterday, they brought in one of the lawyers from that firm to sort of present their findings. So Kimberly Horici is an attorney with that firm. She said that she found sufficient evidence to confirm all of those claims, racist, sexist, and abusive and threatening behavior on the job. And she even read a laundry list of some of the comments that he's and behaviors that he's alleged to have engaged in here in the workplace. So here are a couple of those examples.
Referring to one female district attorney as good-looking girl rather than referring to her by her name. Smacking his lips and making a delighted sound every time a female district attorney walked past. And in one case, suggesting that a female crime victim dress more suggestively or provocatively before meeting with him. And making other inappropriate comments in regards to her case, which was sexual in nature.
And Joe, that's just the beginning of it. I mean, allegedly, he also made racial slurs, including the N-word and others. He made really inappropriate racial jokes and some really explicit and graphic sexual remarks as well.
So Lynn was there in the supervisor's chambers. That's all of this. all of this was playing out, what was his response to this whole thing?
Well, he denies all of these allegations. He did get up during the meeting itself and speak during the public comment period. He also held a press conference immediately after the meeting when he spoke with some reporters. And, you know, he said, "I never said these things." He said, "I'm not racist. I'm not sexist." There was this really, this one really weird exchange, though, I have to say. One reporter asked him, the comments highlighted in this result, in this investigation, are really, really specific. Where could they have come from if not from you, District Attorney Lynn? And you know, Lynn started by saying, well, they could have been made up by the person who filed this claim against me, or this.
It could have come from bits and pieces of things I may have said, spliced together. But I will provide you with the transcript from the investigation. I never made those statements.
But you said this could have been pieced together from various things you did say?
I may have said "the," or I may have one time said "quarter." But I don't believe I ever made that statement. I absolutely know, swear on a stack of Bibles, I never made the statement they're alleging there.
So that's Lynn's response to these allegations. Again, very interesting situation here. Carrie, his denials extend even beyond that, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a little bit of whataboutism maybe that it seems like here, and he's in turn levied some accusations against some supervisors on the board, and claims that in the past, I should say, he's levied these accusations, and he claims that this case being brought against him right now is in fact retaliation for that. So he's accused two of the supervisors on the county board of supervisors of corruption, having to do with campaign finance and some developer contracts.
Now, those are very serious allegations. I believe we have some tape on that, Carrie?
Yeah, that's right. Here's a brief comment from Lynn on that.
I believe that this is a political witch hunt. The two supervisors that spoke this morning are the two that are subject of political investigations by my office. One of whom, Mr. Rogers, seems to allege that I started this, and that is in fact not true.
So again, he's speaking about board member David Rogers and also another mm-hmm. member of the board there.
Right, Brett Frazier, correct.
And again, two things can be equally true, but mm-hmm. if what Lynn is claiming is true, that would be an equally, or let's not equivocate any here, but it would also be a huge bombshell if that actually played out to be true. Do we know anything about the state of this supposed investigation? He is the district attorney. Charges have not been filed at this point, as far as we know. Do we know anything about this investigation?
No, we don't know very much. In fact, you know, he brought it up in the supervisors' meeting yesterday and also in his press conference, he being Lynn, I should say. And it, you know, like, as you heard in that last quote, there's a little bit of he said, she said, you know, where and in fact, some of those county supervisors, in fact, said that at one point Lynn had told them that they were no longer under investigation. This case was closed. And so it's a little bit unclear what the status of that, of all of this is. It also appears that if there were an investigation, it probably was an internal one. But it's really not clear, actually, what those details are at this point. But I did speak with Supervisor Brett Frazier after the meeting. Here was part of his response to that.
He calls it politics as usual, and it's right. It's politics as usual for him. It is a don't look at me, look over here. Like I've stated publicly, he and I looked him right in his eye today and told him when he had come to me and said everything was, there was nothing, no findings of wrongdoing, come to my office to settle it. And then the next week we asked for his resignation. And now all of a sudden it's a big investigation, and it is completely false and inaccurate.
So the board voted unanimously to censure him and ask him to resign. Does this really change anything, though?
It doesn't really. It kind of felt like a formality. I mean, so, you know, by censuring him, they're bringing this information to light. And also one of the things they voted on yesterday was to make public the results of this investigation by the public, by the outside law firm. And so they're now, that's on the Madera County website. It's 40 pages laying out kind of the results of their interviews that they conducted with witnesses. And so that's what happened yesterday, is making all of this public. They don't have the power to actually fire him because he's an elected official. And so that's kind of a big deal. And, you know, from what they all said, they're basically hoping that all this information will just be used by the voters next year when they go to the polls and decide whether Lynn will be able to stay in office.
We'll certainly follow that story and see where that goes, both the allegations against Lynn and the allegations he's leveled. See if there's any truth there. Carrie Klein for Valley Public Radio following that story. Carrie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
California Assemblyman Raul Bocanegra has resigned, effective immediately, after multiple women alleged he groped them or made unwanted sexual advances. Capital Public Radio's Ben Bradford reports Bocanegra is the first state lawmaker to resign following complaints by hundreds of women about a pervasive culture of sexual harassment at the state capitol.
Bocanegra's resignation comes after two Los Angeles Times stories detailed allegations. The San Fernando Valley Democrat said he would not seek re-election just before the second story's publication last week. In a new Facebook post, Bocanegra announced his immediate resignation while continuing to deny the claims, which he says are being used for, quote, personal political gain. Both Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon and We Said Enough, the anti-harassment campaign organized by women at the Capitol, said the one resignation does not solve the larger problem in Sacramento. Governor Jerry Brown must call a special election to fill Bocanegra's vacant seat. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Bradford.
Sexual harassment allegations also continued to surround California State Senator Tony Mendoza. After media reports of inappropriate behavior, many are also calling on him to resign. That raises an interesting question. Does an elected official accused of sexual harassment deserve due process before being forced out of office? Last week, before Bocanegra announced his resignation, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson told Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler there's no bright line, no quick or easy way to meld the rule of law with the court of public opinion for elected officials.
Well, I think we need to be very careful when we decide to remove people from office or ask them to resign from office based on allegations. But I think that when there is a mountain of credible allegations, then it's entirely fair for the voters to say, I'm not comfortable with this person being my representative. And I know that you are innocent until proven guilty, but this is a different standard that we're talking about.
So when someone is accused of sexual harassment in the workplace, there is an HR investigation, and then the company decides to potentially terminate that employee or impose other consequences. In this case, the decision to terminate or impose consequences on an elected official isn't the voters, because that only happens at election time, but it's the colleagues in the Senate or the Assembly.
I think we have to be very careful when politically elected colleagues determine the fate of a politically elected person, because the voters have spoken, but they've spoken before they obtained maybe all the information. So the things we worry about when your elected colleagues can determine your future and whether or not you keep your job, maybe they'll just be an unlikable person who doesn't vote their way and they want to toss them out. So you're worried about things like the majority party trying to trample over members of the minority party. What you do want is to empower someone's colleagues, particularly when we're talking about public officials, to be able to say, we no longer think that this person is fit to serve. So I definitely think you want to wait for more than a news article. I think you want to wait for an investigation, at least to determine that these are credible and believable accusations.
So you think Speaker Rendon's announcement yesterday of stripping Bocanegra of committee posts and majority whip and saying if the investigation affirms these allegations, I'll move to immediately expel. To you, that's a fair position to take.
That is. And again, we're putting a lot of weight and faith into the idea that this is a truly fair, separate, and independent investigation. Assuming that it is, then I actually do think that that's fair. And I think that what we're looking at in Sacramento is a systemic problem. I think that it is fair to put people on notice that this will be taken very seriously. I do not think it's fair to make people fear going out to dinner or going out to drinks because they think someone is going to accuse them of misconduct and then the speaker or their colleagues are going to expel them from their elected position.
Finally, Jessica, what about the role of Proposition 50 in this discussion for the California legislature? It's what voters approved in 2016 that allows the Senate or Assembly to suspend a member with or without pay with a two-thirds vote.
Yeah, and of course that grew out of the scandals from a few years ago where there were state senators who were indicted or even convicted and they were still obtaining their pay. And this was deeply unpopular, of course. There may be a role for suspension. I want to be clear that I don't think we should see that there's an article or there's a news story and there's credible accusations and therefore this person's colleagues should just toss them out. What we should do is ensure that there's a separate independent investigation. And at that point, I think empower politically elected colleagues to either temporarily suspend or potentially even to oust one of their colleagues. Again, we're not talking about minor infractions here. And I think we have to be careful that we're sure that these are activities that rise even potentially to the level of criminal misconduct.
That's Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson, who studies political ethics and governance, speaking with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler. You're listening to Valley Edition. Most people think having health insurance means their medical needs are covered. But for thousands of Californians, insurance claims hit a dead end when plans deny a treatment. Capital Public Radio has discovered a spike in complaints from people who've been denied coverage over the last 5 years. Health reporter Sammy Kayola digs into why.
Nancy Falmouth received her first insurance denial letter this April. Her plan said they'd be covering less of her son's autism therapy. That means fewer hours of this each week.
You're getting quieter at the end, Chris. Hold your volume steady, okay? So are there any vegetables I need to pick today?
Are there any vegetables I need to pick today?
Perfect, okay.
Chris Falmouth has received speech and behavioral therapy in their Northern California home almost every day since he was 3 years old. At age 26, he's still learning conversation skills. So when the insurance plan said they'd be cutting therapy hours, Nancy started to pay the rest out of pocket. In October, they cut his hours again. Nancy says without these sessions, Chris wouldn't be able to attend school, volunteer, or do anything in public because he wouldn't be able to communicate.
This is the only way he learns, is breaking these things down into these very, very simple steps and drilling it 100,000 times, not literally, but a lot. And that's why you need a lot of hours.
More and more patients with complex conditions have had to fight to get their services covered in recent years. Capital Public Radio analyzed data from the California Department of Managed Health Care and found a striking trend. The department reviews twice as many denials now as it did 5 years ago. And it's not just because more people are insured. Enrollment in plans the department oversees saw a much smaller increase. So why are the complaint numbers climbing?
We have conversations with the health plans. They'll say, they'll go right to the bottom line. It's like, well, what is this going to cost?
Liz Helms leads a patient lobbying group called the California Chronic Care Coalition. She says she's noticed an increase in denials since the Affordable Care Act started requiring plans to cover more people and more services.
And all of a sudden now we're getting horror stories. Things are turning back. They're cutting people off. They're making changes.
But Charles Bakke, president of the California Association of Health Plans, says a denial is a medical decision. Things change quickly in healthcare policy and scientific research. When a treatment is new, he says insurers need time to catch up.
Unfortunately, there are times when either the state or the federal government require a new benefit be covered, and there isn't a lot of clarity around what that benefit is and when it's best used. In those cases, you generally see a lot more disputes than you do on a service that is pretty clean cut.
He says he doesn't know why complaints about denials are up, but the Department of Managed Health Care has a process for dealing with them. When an insurance company denies a service because it's experimental or deemed medically unnecessary, the patient starts by filing a grievance with their health plan. If that doesn't work, they can apply for an independent medical review.
This is our IMR complaint form. It's pretty simple. It's a two-page form.
That's Elizabeth Landsberg, deputy director of the department's help center.
We get some information from the health plan, we gather the patient's medical records, and then a specialist with expertise about the kind of care the consumer needs will look at their medical records with fresh eyes and make a decision about whether it's medically necessary.
And here's the important part. Last year, nearly 69% of consumers who requested an independent medical review ended up getting the service that was originally denied. Nancy Felmuth is about to go down that road with her son Chris's autism treatment. She spent months appealing to her plan, but the company hasn't budged.
It's worth it, and we'll do it. But it's their responsibility, because this is what he needs for medical treatment.
She plans to file an independent medical review this week. In Sacramento, I'm Sammy Kayola.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Candidates are already gearing up for California's June primary. Among the offices up for grabs, the open seat for California governor. Over the next few weeks, we'll be talking with some of the candidates running for that office. Today, Republican gubernatorial candidate John Cox. He says the only way to get money out of California politics is to multiply the number of state lawmakers by 100. The San Diego businessman recently spoke with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler.
We're joined by Republican businessman John Cox, a candidate for governor in 2018. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. Pleasure to be with you.
All right, so let's start with the obvious question. Why are you running for governor?
The state has been rendered unaffordable by the politicians in Sacramento. It's got the worst business climate in the country. We're a laughingstock, and I want to change that. I'm a businessman. I've worked for 40 years to build a business, and I'm just disgusted with the political class in Sacramento that keeps making life more expensive. We've got the highest water bills, the highest electricity bills, the highest gasoline and gas tax. Of course, we've got the highest income and sales taxes in the country. The housing prices are out of sight. And on top of that, we've got a political class that has just given away the store to state workers to the extent that we have a $1 trillion unfunded pension liability, nothing put away for retiree health care. This is not a functioning state. We're careening towards a disaster. I don't want to see that happen, and I want to make sure it's sustainable for my 12-year-old daughter.
So that might be an explanation of what you see as being wrong with California and with California policy and politics, but it's not necessarily an argument for why you should run for governor. So why you, as opposed to any of the other candidates in the race? And there are a lot of other candidates.
Well, good point. And it's the politicians that have messed things up, and I'm running against five politicians. I'm a businessman. 19 states around the country have already elected businessmen, happens to be they're all men, including blue states like Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan. I'm a CPA and an attorney and a businessman, just like Rick Snyder in Michigan. And if you know what's happened in Michigan, it's really turned around. I think that's a track record that will maybe give the people of California some confidence that things can get turned around here.
What do you like about what Jerry Brown has done as governor, and what do you dislike?
Well, it'd be hard to really say. I mean, I guess the one thing that I actually have liked about him is that he's tried to exercise some measure of adult supervision up there, which is not saying a lot, given some of the stuff that Governor Brown has done over the years. But, you know, I mean, some of this stuff against President Trump is just bordering on the surreal and ridiculous. And he's vetoed a chunk of it. Unfortunately, he didn't veto some of the most ridiculous stuff, like the sanctuary state bill. You know, what I don't like is that he has established almost no measure of fiscal rectitude in this government. I mean, the budget keeps going up. They've not done anything substantive about attacking pensions. They've done a little bit on the margins, but nothing really substantial. They've tried, they say, to do something about housing, and then he signs a bill that purports to make housing affordable, but it raises prevailing wages for union workers who work on homes, which experts say drives up the cost $40,000, $50,000 a home. So with one hand, the legislature is handing out some subsidies to a few lucky people, and the other hand, they're taking it away by driving up the cost. This is ridiculous.
the California Republican Party, like the National Republican Party, there's this split that everyone talks about between the Trump wing and the establishment wing, the business-friendly wing, you might say. You're a businessman. One might assume that as a businessman, you might fall more in the establishment camp. Do you?
No, I wouldn't say that. I'm a small businessman. I'm not a crony. I'm not one who gives money to politicians to get favors. And I think that marks me as anti-establishment. I'm about best practices. I'm about doing the right thing for the state of California. And if that involves using an idea that a Democrat comes up with, I'll do it. Now, as a Republican, who started out, by the way, as a Democrat, I've come to the Republican Party because I believe in people being able to solve problems and the private sector solving problems much better than government.
We're talking with Republican businessman John Cox, who's running for governor in 2018. If I understand correctly, you did not vote for President Trump last year. You've since said that you support him and support what he's doing in Washington. Is that accurate, or what's your view on the president?
Yeah, I approached that election in 2016, like a lot of Americans. I certainly wasn't going to vote for Hillary Clinton. By the same token, though, you know, Donald Trump had given money to Hillary and given money to Chuck Schumer many times. He had made a few statements about having, you know, government expand health care in some respects, and I thought it should, you know, not be involved in health care. I was concerned about his personality and about his style. So I voted for Gary Johnson, which was not a good choice in many ways, but it was a bad choice all the way around. And I will say today, sitting here today, that it was a mistake. Knowing what President Trump has done in terms of signing rollbacks of regulation, in terms of putting Betsy DeVos at Education and Scott Gottlieb at FDA, those were both horribly run agencies. In terms of the tax reform he's trying to put forth, I fundamentally agree in reducing marginal tax rates. I am very impressed with his Supreme Court choice, Neil Gorsuch, so I love that. So I'm very, very supportive of the things he got. I mean, I had great hopes for George W. Bush, and to me, he's a big disappointment because he raised spending and he increased the size of government. A lot of conservatives like me felt that was a betrayal. I was not interested in repeating that, but so far, President Trump has come through on reducing regulation, reducing the size of government.
Speaking of putting money into political causes, it's something that you've done. You've attempted to fund initiatives, a neighborhood legislature initiative, and a what you called a NASCAR-style campaign finance reform, where lawmakers on the floor of the Senate and Assembly would have to wear patches with the logos of their largest donors. Now you're going to put some money into the gas tax repeal effort, correct?
Yeah, I've signed on to be a chairman of the Give Voters a Voice effort to repeal the gas tax constitutionally, so it can't be put back in. Well, you know, it's all part of the same piece, Ben, and that is I believe that government does so much damage. It does a lot of good things, don't get me wrong, but it also, because it's usually in the hands of cronies and campaign funders, especially in California right now, it's really damaging a lot of things. The NASCAR idea, you know, you referred to was an effort to call attention to a system that's basically indefensible.
Your initiative could have been described as a bit of a stunt itself.
It was. It was to call attention to the problem. The solution, though, is the neighborhood legislature, because I've looked at so many solutions to campaign finance. You know, we've tried so many things in this country. Limits on contributions, limits on spending, public financing. They don't work. And the reason they don't work is as long as the districts and the campaigns are driven by media and television and radio, they're going to be expensive. And the people who are elected are going to have to dance to the tune of the people who give the money. So the only solution that I think I found that would really open up the process and get rid of the power of money is to make the money unnecessary. And that's this idea of a neighborhood legislature, where all the districts are so tiny, you get elected by going door to door.
You've put money into those measures, but then you've stopped. If a voter strongly believes that the gas tax should be repealed, and a lot of Republicans do, and they see you've put your name and you say you're going to put your money behind it, how can they trust that you'll follow through with that?
Well, wait a minute. The NASCAR one, we collected some signatures. We did it, as you say, as a stunt to basically illustrate the problem. We were collecting signatures, and Jerry Brown went in with, you know, millions of dollars and drove up the cost of signature gathering, so we abandoned that. But that
the governor was gathering signatures for his own measures on a tight timeline, so yeah. The signature gathering companies started charging a lot of money. It got to be very expensive.
Yeah, and I said that's not the measure that I want to get qualified, so I abandoned that. The neighborhood legislature, we hope to get that qualified, so I'm following through. There's no question I'm following through.
How many signatures are you submitting?
Well over 800,000. So we think it'll be qualified.
Do you think it'll be constitutional?
Absolutely.
Should California have a full-time legislature?
I'll give that to the people to decide. The neighborhood legislature will probably make themselves part-time. They won't be fundraisers. Remember, when you're elected in a real tiny district, I'm talking only 5,000 people here, Ben, you're not going to need to raise money. You're going to, you know, basically almost know everybody in your district. And that way, the funders lose power. I think that's going to be a very attractive thing to a lot of people.
You believe that it has a shot at passage?
Oh, I think when people understand it and know about it. You know, the trouble is that the media, some members of the media, not you, have floated the headline, oh, it's 12,000 legislators, as if 12,000 people are going to be sent to Sacramento. And, of course, that's not what happens. The neighborhood legislature involves assembling these 12,000 districts statewide, but 99% of those people stay home. They send a committee of 120 people to Sacramento to do all the work, and the 12,000 people that are in the neighborhoods go about their life and keep tabs on the people in Sacramento.
Why couldn't the 120 people who go to Sacramento be targeted by special interests and lobbyists and fall prey to the same challenges that you see befalling the current legislature?
Well, they could, but remember, each one of those 120 people has to get elected each time in their little tiny district. And so let's say you're one of those people that goes to Sacramento, Ben, and I live in your district, and I'm going to run against you, and I'm going to go door to door with a record of all the money you've raised, and I'm going to tell every one of our neighbors, look, Ben's a nice guy, he's on radio, he's a nice guy, but he went to Sacramento and raised a whole bunch of money from a lot of people that want something from government. I'm not going to do that. Elect me. Now, who do you think is going to win that election?
Finally, the California Republican Party has less than 26% of registered California voters, no statewide office holders, and super minorities in the legislature. What do you believe is the best path back to relevance for California Republicans? Is it with President Trump? Is it with the business community and industry groups? Is it somewhere in between?
Listen, Maryland has a Republican registration of 20%. But the governor of Maryland is Larry Hogan, who's about my age, has white hair like I do, is a real estate guy like I do, and happens to be a conservative Republican like me. And his approval rating now, he's been in office for 3 years, almost 3 years, his approval rating is 75%. I would submit to you that the people of California want a better state. They want life affordable. They want a business climate that actually allows small business to operate. I believe they'll be very, very happy to hear my message and will not only elect me governor, but will make me one of the most popular governors in the country. And I'll love nothing better because I'll be making life better here for my family as well as yours and everybody else's.
John Cox, a Republican businessman who's running for governor of California in 2018. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate it.
And we'll continue our conversation with gubernatorial candidates next week with Democrat Delaine Easton. And stay with us. In the next part of our program, we'll learn about efforts to improve the pathway from high school to college for California high school seniors and new efforts to open a new library in Tehachapi. It's coming next Monday. We'll get a scoop. That's all coming up here on Valley Edition.
Today is Giving Tuesday, and FM 89 asks, how public are you? Show us that you believe in the importance of public radio with your tax-deductible gift today at kbvr.org or with the FM 89 app.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A new report says at the current pace, only about 30% of California high school students will earn a bachelor's degree. And even though the state has been working hard to raise those numbers over the last decade, only about 45% of graduating high school seniors last school year completed the college prep courses required to get into the UC or CSU systems. To make matters worse, even if those numbers increased, California's public higher education system isn't ready to handle them. To learn more, we have with us today Niu Gao, one of the report's authors. She is a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, which published the study today. Niu, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You write that even students that start out on track in math and English, these two critical courses when it comes to college readiness, even those that are on track are falling off the path to being ready for college. What's happening there?
Yeah, so definitely we do see a very widespread progression problems. So, for instance, in high school, students need to take Algebra 1, Geometry, and Algebra 2 if they want to be considered for admission to the UC or CSU. And when we're looking at student pathway in high school, what we found is, you know, a lot of students are falling off the A to G track. So, for instance, among students who passed Algebra 1, only 66% of them moved on to take geometry in later years. In other words, about 34% of the students, they do not take geometry in later years. And similarly, among students who passed geometry, about 40% of them did not take Algebra 2 in later years. And this affects a wide range of students. So for instance, when we are looking at students who are high performers, so for instance, those students who have passed Algebra 1 with an A or B, these are very high performing students. Still, among these students, about a third of them do not advance to the next level of math course. So there's a very widespread progression problems affecting a wide range of students.
Now, you also write that California is somewhat unique in this, especially when it comes to requirements for courses like math compared to other states. How does that play into this?
Yeah, definitely. So we've seen a lot of evidence that high school graduation requirements really play a very important role in affecting student course taking patterns. And in our report, what we found when we're looking at California's minimum high school graduation requirements, you know, in math, the requirement is 2 years. But as we know, UC and CSU, they require 3 years of math. And when we compare California to other states, actually California is one of the three states that requires only 2 years of math. So other states have all required 3 years or more. So high school graduation requirements really play an important role in student course takings.
You write a lot about pathways in this report, but there's really three components going on here, or at least three. You have those students who wind up applying to college. Then you have those students who wind up completing college. And then you have those who fall short of either of those. How much of the problem is on the pathway side before the students get to a CSU school? And how much of it is degree completion once they're already applied, accepted, and now they're in but not progressing through their collegiate studies?
Yeah, so in terms of CSU, well, we generally speaking, CSU admits the one top third of high school graduates. And by definition, those students, you know, they have completed A to D courses. And when we're looking at these courses, those students who are eligible for CSU, what we have seen is in the last 4 years, you know, more than 69,000 of them have been turned away by CSU because capacity constraint at certain CSU campuses. And for those students, you know, they're eligible for CSU, but they weren't able to, you know, get a slot at CSU campuses. And among students, you know, who have made it into CSU, persistence is really, in our report, we found persistence is very, very critical because generally speaking, CSU has a low completion rate, and which means that persistence is very low in those campuses. And in terms of persistence, the first 2 years is very critical to CSU completion.
when you talk to leaders of CSU campuses, and we have two in our area, Fresno State and CSU mm-hmm. Bakersfield, we talk to those presidents, Horace Mitchell and Joseph Castor, they both will tell you that getting students through is one of the ways to solve that capacity problem. Is that something that you're finding as well? Does what you just told me also relate to that in that if students are taking longer than 4 years to get a degree or mm-hmm. maybe going through taking up that time and not ultimately getting a degree, is that in some way excluding some students? Speaking again in the system as a whole, because every campus is a little different, yes. Is that part of the capacity problem?
Improving, you know, graduation rates definitely helps. And at the same time, you know, as K-12 schools improve the college readiness of their high school graduates, more and more, you know, we're going to have more and more students who are eligible for UC or CSU. And in fact, you know, there is a recent eligibility study finding that 40% of the high school graduates are actually eligible for CSU. But according to the Higher Education Master Plan, the eligibility threshold was at top one-third. So you see there's a gap between the number of students who are eligible and also, you know, the number of students CSU can take. So improving graduation requirements definitely helps, but at the same time, you know, because the source of the problem is coming from multiple factors, so we need, you know, a variety of policy interventions to work together to address the problem.
You mentioned the master plan for higher education that the state adopted back in 1960. Certainly, yes. It's hard to discuss the CSU or UC without mentioning that. The original mm-hmm. idea there being the UC would accept the top one-eighth of students, and then yes. CSU would take the top third. What is the current status of that, and have there been changes, and should there be more?
No, nothing that we are aware of. As you've mentioned, the master plan was developed more than 50 years ago. And now, because the state economy is completely different, and also the K-12 education system is different, so it is about time that we rethink and redesign the master plan to make sure that, you know, all of the eligible students are having access to UC or CSU.
So what sort of changes does your report look at?
In terms of policy recommendations, we offer a few. At high school level, we recommend a couple of options. So for instance, we think that, you know, schools should work to increase the number of A to G approved courses. And statewide, you know, not every high school offers the full A to G sequence. And if we want to improve A to G completion rates for all, we need to make sure that, you know, all of the high schools should at least offer the full A to G sequence. That is one of our policy recommendations. And another thing is, you know, to update the state's high school graduation requirements. As I've mentioned earlier, when we compare the state's minimum requirements to UC CSU expectation and also to other states' expectation, what we see is, you know, the California in general lags behind, you know, UC CSU or other states. So because high school graduation requirements are very important policy lever, we think that the state policymakers really need to rethink and update the high school graduation requirements. And both in high school and in community colleges, a very effective course placement, course counseling, and course advising systems will be very important to make sure that students stay on the track to and through college. So one of the examples will be, instead of, for instance, in high school, instead of having students opt into A to G courses, we can change the course placement system such that students have to opt out A to G courses. So the small nudge could have a very big potential in terms of improving A to G course taking. In CSU, we've talked about the master plan, and capacity is a very, very big issue facing CSU, and policymakers really need to rethink and redesign the master plan to make sure that all of the students are having access to UC CSU.
Is there any scholarship, or is there any research out there that suggests what that degree completion rate should be for a state like California with an economy like we have today? If 30% is insufficient, where should that number rest ultimately? What should the state's goal be?
I think, you know, PBSC recently released another study saying, you know, by 2025, California needs, you know, 1.1 million more workers with a college degree. And right now, the CSU's six-year graduation rate is about, you know, less than 60% or 50%. I'm not aware of any study that looks at what is the optimal graduation rate should be.
At the same time, we're having this discussion just a couple of months ago in August. The CSU Chancellor's Office issued an order that eliminates remedial classes for degree completion for a number of majors for freshmen that are incoming to the university. That has also long been a problem. How does that issue fit into this? If you're talking about having a higher standard at the high school level, are we seeing CSUs in some way lower their standard at that level?
I think, you know, in our report, we do talk about, you know, a lot of the reforms because, you know, at each sector, for including K-12, community college, and as you've mentioned, and the CSU, there's a lot of reforms going on, you know, right now to address the college completion and also college enrollment. And I think, you know, we think those reforms, they have great potential, and more research, you know, is needed to monitor the implementation of those reforms and to evaluate, you know, to eventually evaluate its efficacy. So right now, it's too early to see, you know, whether or not these reforms are effective or not. But, you know, we think, you know, those reforms, we should not play, you know, downplay the role of those reforms because they're important steps towards the right direction.
We've been talking a lot about the CSU in this conversation, but there's also community colleges. How do they fit into this picture? And I know we've done a good bit of reporting here on our station about an effort that's underway in Kern County right now between the Kern High School District, Bakersfield College, which is a community college, and CSUB. They call it the Kern Promise, and it's designed to emphasize these pathways and get students on track to get that degree. How do community colleges fit into this equation?
So statewide, you know, among students who do enroll in a post-secondary institution, most of them enroll in the community college, means California Community College. So community college definitely is a really important player in the whole picture. And in our report, you know, one of the largest barriers to student success in community college is the need for remediation courses. So in general, those are not college-level courses. And for many students, they are simply repeating high school courses. And those remediation courses, you know, are perhaps one of the largest barriers to student success in community college. And in our report, what we found is even among students who are ready to take transfer-level courses in community colleges, about 20% of them end up taking remediation courses. Those courses, again, they really slow those students down and prevent them from completing community college in time. So again, we see another mismatch between student academic potential and their course-taking patterns. This is similar to what we've seen in the high school setting, and this really affects a wide range of students as well. So community college, you know, if we can address, you know, and community college right now, there are some reforms, for instance, AB 705, requiring community colleges to use multiple measures. And we think, you know, this could potentially address, you know, some of the mismatch or misplacement issues that we've seen in community colleges. And addressing those barriers, because community college is a really important player in, you know, in the picture, addressing the barriers in community college can have a really big impact in terms of improving students transfer to four-year colleges.
We've been talking with Niu Gao, one of the authors of a new report from the nonprofit Public Policy Institute of California on college readiness and degree completion among California high school seniors. You can find the report online at ppic.org. Niu, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Public Radio. Starting next year, a medical card won't be necessary to purchase marijuana, just an ID, like when you buy alcohol or cigarettes. But like those other legal substances, weed carries some health hazards. Capital Public Radio's Sammy Cayola fills you in.
Before anyone starts buying recreational pot, public health officials are launching the Let's Talk Cannabis campaign.
So this is an opportunity for us to sort of say, hey, you know, now that it's legal, let's talk about what we do and don't know about this and who really does have a risk.
Dr. Karen Smith is the state's public health director. Since pot has been banned for so long, she says researchers haven't fully studied its effects. But they know a few key things. Consuming marijuana while pregnant or breastfeeding can cause brain damage and low birth weight. Teenage users are at risk for memory and attention problems. The Let's Talk Cannabis campaign is funded with $4 million from Prop 64. That's the measure that legalized pot in 2016. It tells people where they can safely store weed and how to test the potency of an edible, among other things. Dr. Smith says cannabis is stronger now than it used to be.
There are plenty of people who haven't used cannabis since they were in college who are going to want to try again. And a lot of people don't want to smoke and would rather eat it. We want them to know that they should be cautious to start.
The hope is that all of this advice will trickle down to the local level. Dr. Lynn Silver is with the Oakland nonprofit Public Health Institute. She says cities and counties will face big decisions about where dispensaries should be, what they can sell, and how they should market marijuana products with health risks in mind.
I don't think we want anyone going to jail for marijuana, but we also don't want marijuana to be the greatest thing since sliced bread.
State officials will begin issuing retail marijuana licenses January 1st.
And the legalization of recreational cannabis isn't just about people. There's also lots of cannabis products marketed for dogs and cats. They claim to ease pain and reduce anxiety, but do they work? And are they safe? In part two of her report, Sammy Kayola sniffed out the facts.
Western Feed and Pet Supply in Sacramento is a huge garage-like space with that classic pet store smell of rawhide bones and rubber toys. They keep their cannabis products right at the front counter.
Okay, so this is the CBD topical spray. So if your dog will ingest it, it's for like...
Saleswoman Rosie Montero says the store's treats, ointments, and gel caps containing CBD are extremely popular. CBD is a chemical compound derived from marijuana and hemp plants. But CBD doesn't contain THC, the psychoactive ingredient that gets people high.
Drop it in their food, drop it in their mouth, on their nose, and they'll lick it up and it'll calm them down. Help with any older dog with arthritis, hip and joint problems.
There's been very little scientific research on medical cannabis use in animals. That's why UC Davis just launched a survey for pet owners who give these products to their furry companions. Dr. Jamie Payton is chief of their integrative medicine service.
We're trying to get more information so then we can then get more funding for research as well as help owners navigate what's out there because there are really no good regulations at this time for safety.
The FDA does monitor pet treats, and they've issued warnings to some companies making medical claims about CBD products. The California Veterinary Medical Board bans vets from prescribing or even recommending marijuana and hemp for animals. Either way, lots of people are using it. Montero gives the CBD oil sold at her store to her own dogs. She says it calms her puppy Duke down, but doesn't make him dazed and confused. She gives it to her 11-year-old lab Bacchus for arthritis, too.
He moves around like an old dog, but when I give him the CBD oil, it's like he's a new dog, like puppy energy level.
Whether you've got a bird, a snake, or a goat, the UC Davis survey is open to all pet owners. In Sacramento, I'm Sammy Kayola.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's going to be an exciting Monday next week for the residents of Tehachapi. They're getting a new library. The existing branch of the Tehachapi Library is opening in a new location right in the heart of downtown. Here joining us to tell us more is Jasmine Labasso with the Kern County Public Library. Jasmine, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, and this is very exciting as I was just down there a few weeks ago and saw the new facility. This has to be something that's very exciting for everyone in the Kern County Library system right now, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. This location is absolutely gorgeous, and it is in a beautiful part of the city. And we're very, very, very excited about the Tehachapi Branch Library.
So Tehachapi residents have had a library for some time, but it's been in a different location. Why the move downtown?
We decided when we were looking at the branch, we wanted to expand square footage and have more of a focus on technology within the branch. And we also wanted to, Tehachapi is a walkable community. We really, really wanted the branch to identify with that. And that the new location completely is in line with that.
So now this is not a new building entirely. I understand it was formerly a Masonic Lodge. Was there a lot of work necessary to bring this up to standards for a public facility?
Yes, absolutely. It was a Masonic lodge, and it was not in use at the time when we first looked at the building, and it's been completely renovated inside. Everything is new, and it's all been from the top down redone.
So what can people expect when they come out to the big opening on December 4th?
We're really excited because this new branch has outdoor space. So we're hoping to do a whole bunch of outdoor programming. There's spots for people to sit outside and read. We plan to do a lot more community partnering. We have a lot more programming space in this new building because it's 1,000 square feet more. We have more technology. There's dedicated kids and adults computers. There's dedicated space for children and, as I said, programming. There's a meeting room for the community with a screen projector. There's just a lot more possible in this new location.
I know this was supposed to happen a little while ago. November 13th was supposed to be the opening. Why the delay?
The delay is because we actually had to do a little more retrofitting for seismic standards for the bookshelves.
Yeah, it's certainly a worthy cause, especially in a community that knows something about devastating earthquakes, as the one that hit the community back in the 1950s. Oh, what's the response been like from the community so far? I know that people haven't gotten to see the full scope of what's inside yet, but have people responded to the calls to help fill out some of the things on the wish list?
Oh, absolutely. The community is very, very excited. Everybody that's come by really wants to see the branch open. And we've received almost $15,000 in donations to purchase 3D printing machines and to purchase advertising materials and to purchase a whole bunch of different new materials for the community.
You mentioned printing machines. Are these computer printers or are these 3D printers?
3D printers.
Wow. So tell me a little more about that. Is this something that the Kern County Library is going to be doing more of? And why 3D printers in a space we usually think of as just being about books?
Absolutely. We plan to do more STEM-related programming in general for the Tehachapi branch. The 3D printers will help facilitate that for the community. We got a donation for 2 3D printers, so we're really, really excited to introduce a lot more of programming and partnering with the community to make sure the STEM opportunities are available for the public.
What else do you need? I know there's still a lot of items on that wish list. What else would you like?
Yes, there is. We still need a little more money for signage. We're also looking to replace our tables and chairs. We're looking for an iPad and an iPad station. We still need a little more money for reading materials for children's, teens, and adults. We are also still hoping to get a little more money for outreach materials as well and to cover the window blinds for the second floor.
So with all that going on, what can people expect for the big ribbon cutting that's taking place next Monday?
We plan to have family activities around on the ribbon cutting day and during the grand opening. We'll have several representatives from local leaders coming during the ribbon cutting, and then also the director of the libraries and a lot of large county people will be there to actually facilitate the ribbon cutting.
All right, again, it's coming up Monday. It's the brand new opening of a new facility for the Tehachapi Public Library, part of the Kern County Public Library System. It's at 212 South Green Street, right in downtown Tehachapi, and it's opening to the public on Monday for the first time. Again, we've been talking with Jasmine Labasso with the Kern County Public Library. Thank you so much, Jasmine.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, and find our podcast and audio archives on the website, kvpr.org, as well. For Valley Edition's reporters, Carrie Klein and Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.